This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We hear a lot of senior male scientists, politicians, and experts from the big polluting countries talking about climate change. But the first and maybe the worst impacts, they say, will hit women who did little to cause the problem, especially in the global south. And women are taking the lead in climate activism all over the world. In this Radio EcoShock program, we're lucky to connect with Maria Alejandra Rodriguez Acha. She's a young anthropologist, teacher, and activist who co-founded and co-leads an environment group in Peru. Known as Mahandra, she's attended several key climate conferences, including the Paris COP21 meeting. Mahandra, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you get started in climate activism?
I kind of came to it through several different avenues. I would say when I was a teenager living in Peru in 2009, there were protests in the Peruvian Amazon by an indigenous group, primarily the Achuar, against new legislation that was passed by the national government that essentially facilitated the takeover of their lands and the privatization of their lands. And they located a highway in the northern Amazon region of the country and were met with very violent police repression mandated by the central government. Peru, it's important to know that Peru is a highly centralized country. So all of the government decisions, kind of the economic hub, it's all of it is located in Lima. And there's a lot of migration that happens to the city. But what goes on outside of the capital city is often not a political priority. There's not much good communication, good infrastructure, et cetera. So this was a situation where the central government mandated a strong, aggressive response to a protest, which essentially spiraled into violence, and there were multiple deaths. This was something that was aired on national TV. And it was something that, to me, growing up as someone who is urban, who lives in the city in Lima, but who has traveled significantly around Peru and is familiar with the diversity of both geographically and also culturally of my country, it was just shocking to see these images of violence on the TV screen and to know that this was happening in my country and to feel, you know, how disconnected people living in the city, especially middle classes living in the city, are from these realities and how our governments, our national governments, were taking part of violent repression, and we're responsible for violent repression on our, you know, in our name. So to me, that was something that was just, you know, just like on an emotional level was just very impactful. You know, I mean, because of gender roles, it's the men who are out blockading, but it's the women who are there with them doing the cooking and taking care of the wounded and taking care of the children. You know, I mean, these gender roles exist in all of our societies, and they're expressed in different ways. But in this context, you could also see, like, the specific suffering of women in particular and what that looks like and just sort of the pain and how it's also expressed just so viscerally. So, I think it's, and in general, Peru, we have over 200 current conflicts. These are social environmental conflicts that occur throughout the country, mostly because of dispute around mining projects, around deforestation, around land titles. There are oftentimes protests against legislation, whether it be at the local level, regional level, national level, or companies coming in, foreigners coming in, and essentially taking over indigenous lands. And we have such a weak kind of structure, legal structure, to protect indigenous people's rights to land, that we see these conflicts occur throughout the country and people having to mobilize and to take over highways and to, you know, call attention in whatever way they can because the laws don't protect them. It's like historically, they've been historically oppressed and historically marginalized populations. They're not the priority of politicians. The national media doesn't cover these stories. And there's just a lot of discontent, you know, and I think it's historical, it's cultural, it just expresses so many underlying structural factors of inequality and of violence in the country. So to me, growing up, you know, this was just one very kind of shocking instance of that, but it's an ongoing trait that really characterizes Peru and the Peruvian context.
Well, I have to say, though, that some of those same conflicts happened in my own country in Canada, where Indigenous people have been treated terribly for a couple of centuries and a lot of violence towards them. And I also must say that some of the mining companies that are coming to Peru come from Canada. They are mega companies here. Very little awareness of it in Canada. I bet a lot of my Canadian listeners have their pension plans or their mutual funds invested in those mining companies and don't know about it. So that's something that we've got to wake up to at this end. But I'd like to move up to the global, the macro scale here. And I want to ask you, as a woman from the global south, what's your take on the Paris Climate Agreement of 2015?
Yeah. Definitely being there and also, you know, following the more technical process, it was just such a frustrating experience, really, to see that it, you know, kind of unfold in front of me almost and without really the possibility of intervening. So, you know, as civil society observers in official UN negotiations, you can sit in the back. Oftentimes there are limited passes. Sometimes you can't even sit in the room. You have to be outside watching on a screen, which, you know, you might as well not even be there. But if you are able to be in the room, you're sitting in the back, you can't say a word, you can't clap, you can't, you know, show any sign of support or opposition to what's going on. You just have to kind of silently observe what's being decided, really, again, on your behalf. You know, these are our governments, our national governments that are theoretically representing us and our best interests. And so, to me, it was just a very frustrating experience to be sitting in those rooms and in that room and listening to those conversations and really feeling how, or really seeing how power dynamics and economic interests and sort of the global political structures, all of that kind of unfold and play out as well, like on a very real level, you know, seeing how, for example, small island states who say, you know, 2 degrees is a death sentence for us. Like we need to limit warming to 1.5, and seeing there be kind of wrangling and negotiation around that and in a way blackmail, you know, some things had to be taken out in order for the 1.5 to even be mentioned. And even how it's mentioned, it's like, oh, we'll do our best efforts to limit, you know, pursue efforts to limit warming to 1.5. And that's just kind of, to me, it seems like a token gesture. But it's, you know, 2 degrees remains the limit. And so even for that to be in the agreement, other things have to be taken out. Like, for example, loss and damage, which are, you know, the impact of climate change to which we cannot adapt, which include deaths, which include the entire sinking of countries, of island states. You know, that, you know, had to be very much weakened in the agreement. So it feels like it was very much the lowest common denominator in terms of ambition. In terms of also just following what the science is telling us, you know, the Paris Agreement says, like, we must abide by the best available science. But, you know, honestly, I don't see that actually playing out in the negotiations. To me, again, it's the lowest common denominator. Some people have called it, you know, the best possible outcome in an imperfect world, where you have these power dynamics, where you have the possibility of this kind of political manipulation and where countries can get away without being guided by the best available science, which is telling us that 2 degrees is coming, you know, faster than ever predicted, and that we really are on a path of ever more spiraling global warming, and we're not doing enough in the face of that. So, you know, definitely a very highly frustrating experience. It's definitely better for there to be something, though even this is contested, you know, for there to be some sort of policy structure and some sort of language where I can then go to the Peruvian government and say, well, what are you doing to actually abide by your commitments to limit global warming and to act in the face of climate change? It's something, it's a tool, and activists and advocates and citizens can use that. But at the same time, it's a highly limited tool. And for some, it's even a distraction, you know, from really taking action and from really waking up. Because, you know, I think one thing that the Paris Agreement cannot lead us to is complacency. And is, you know, we cannot just say, oh, sit back and say, oh, governments are taking care of this, because they're not.
That's so true. I want to ask you in particular, does feminism have a role to play in the response to climate change?
So, yes, it does. While climate change does affect humankind, we're talking about global warming, we're talking about planetary scale shifts. Some people are impacted more than others, and that is because of different access to resources, different access to opportunities that can grant us the possibility to be resilient, to adapt, and to protect ourselves, protect our lives, our bodies in the face of natural disasters, in the face of slow onset climate change. So, and it's not a coincidence that often this occurs along race lines, along class lines, along gender lines, along lines of ability, and other categories of inequality that exist in our different societies and communities and spaces that we inhabit, and especially from an intersectional feminist perspective. So recognizing that, again, it's not necessarily all women. It's women particularly in the global south, particularly indigenous women, particularly rural women who live in direct dependence on nature, on forests, on waterways, on timber for food, in those direct dependent relationships, in context of gender-based inequality, where, for example, men are the ones who migrate to cities to access wage labor, and women are the ones who stay behind with the children and rely on subsistence agriculture. You know, in those instances, in when a natural disaster hits, men have more access to resources, money, and kind of the ability to move than women who are in more direct dependence, again, on the earth and on their natural environment, and who don't have access to this wage income. And we're talking about, you know, this is one instance. There's wage inequality based on gender lines throughout the world, and this varies in different contexts, but there is an overall inequality in our current societies. There's around inequalities around land titles, inequalities around mobility, inequalities around access to political spaces and opportunities and voice and impact on the media. So, you know, gender-based inequality and also racial inequality and class-based inequality and all the forms of inequality that determine and characterize our societies definitely play a significant role in climate change, because, again, while climate, you know, the climate is changing for all of us, some of us have access to certain resources in the face of that, and others don't. So on one hand, that's important in terms of vulnerability. I'm talking about impact, but it's also relevant when talking about what knowledge do we have at hand, what practices do we have at hand that can help us in the face of climate change. And this is, again, where gender roles play an important role, because in certain contexts, culturally and historically and socially, women have access to, for example, knowledge around seed saving and knowledge around biodiversity protection that can be very relevant in the face of climate change, because we're talking about the need for protecting seeds and the need for having a greater variety of crops that can adapt to a changing climate. And so, you know, on one hand, we're talking about vulnerability and inequality and the role that that plays. And on the other hand, we're also talking about what tools do we have, what knowledge do we have at hand that can help us face climate change and survive and protect ourselves.
I totally agree with what you just said. And I want to ask you, for women in less developed countries who are worried about climate change, what are the barriers to their speaking and organizing?
I mean, I think it definitely varies from context to context. I can speak about my own environment, my own context. Peru is one of the countries that has the highest rates of femicide, the highest rates of sexual violence and of domestic violence, violence within romantic relationships. And so harassment is something that women face, even from, you know, a daily level of in the household and participating in on a more neighborhood level, to even women in political positions and women who are journalists who face harassment and intimidation based on sexual violence, you know, on a constant basis. So, the violence is definitely a big barrier to women participating and women's voices being taken into account. There's definitely also, huge inequality, I mean, along socioeconomic lines. And so land titling is pretty significant, especially in rural areas. And so men are typically the ones who hold land titles, even though women often make up the majority of the workforce on farms. And so women are working but aren't legally owning and therefore don't necessarily have access to credit, for example, or to agricultural support from the government because they're not on paper, even though they might be the ones who are actually living there and working there, and the men have migrated to the city. So it's a lot of interconnected factors at play, and it definitely varies from urban areas to rural areas to indigenous communities and what this kind of socioeconomic inequality and also what violence and sexual violence in particular can mean, you know, in these different contexts.
Radio EcoShock.
Well, you are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, speaking with the Peruvian anthropologist and climate activist Maria Alexandra Rodriguez Acha. Mahandra, can you give us some examples of feminist climate activism or of women that have really inspired you?
Sure. I can think of many. I think one group in particular that I would like to mention that is a new group. It's a young group. It's kind of a collection of young feminist activists from around the world who have been engaged in the UN climate negotiations, who are very much engaged at a local level, national level in organizing and doing activism for climate justice in their context. It's a network called Young Feminists for Climate Justice. It exists as a Facebook platform for sharing information. It exists as a listserv. We got together in Paris in 2015 at COP21, have kind of several projects in mind, have had a webinar last year to talk about intersectionality and feminism and climate justice and what are all of these connections, you know, how is feminism relevant for climate justice and all of that. To me, it's an exciting space because it's open. It's, you know, anyone who's interesting, who self-identifies as a young feminist for climate justice is welcome to join. There's a lot of potential in spaces like those that are collections of passionate, committed people for whom geographical barriers aren't important, who definitely do have the privilege of accessing platforms like Facebook and having internet access. So definitely diverse, but, you know, there are always limitations to that, and it's important to recognize and to recognize the challenges that we still have to being really, truly inclusive and diverse. But it's a space that I think is exciting and that I think has a lot of potential and that really gathers a collection of people who, again, are so passionate and so committed to activism on a local scale as well.
Well, I'll put a link to that in my show blog at ecoshock.org so people can find it for sure. And in your article in the Huffington Post a while ago, you listed some special days to raise awareness of feminism and indigenous women. Mahandra, what's coming up?
Yeah, well, I would definitely encourage people to check out events going on at a local level. At the same time, it's always good to stay tuned to what's going on in terms of the UN climate negotiations and kind of what our governments are doing on, again, you know, governments that represent us, so on our behalf, and to guarantee our well-being, what's being said in the UN climate talks. So there are intersessional climate negotiations in Bonn in mid-May. And then COP23, which is crazy to think about, but it's almost, you know, this year's COP23, and it's going to be in Germany in November. There is the 61st Commission on the Status of Women, which is the annual UN space for talking about women's rights and the progress that governments are taking or have in terms of securing women's rights. And there are multiple, again, conferences and events and things going on at more local and national levels. I believe there's a Young Feminist Leadership Conference in the U.S., I believe in April, if I'm not mistaken.
Lots coming up. Have you heard much about the drought in neighboring Bolivia?
Yes, I've heard some. Tierra Activa, which is the group that I'm a part of in Peru, has a partner organization in Bolivia called Tierra Activa Bolivia, and they've been raising awareness around the vanishing of Lake Popo, which is a lake that has been completely dried out. It has vanished in its entirety. And this is due to the drought. It's due to rising temperatures. It's also due to pollution and deforestation at a local level. So in the case of Bolivia, it's important, especially as foreigners. You know, oftentimes we can hear stories about how the Bolivian government is historic and in that it takes into account Mother Nature and Mother Earth and the rights of nature. But on the ground, it's a government that is still promoting fossil fuel-based development, that is promoting nuclear energy, that is building highways on protected indigenous territories, and that has really, you know, there are tensions currently in terms of national movements and in the indigenous rights movements as well, in terms of the direction that the government has taken, which has been a huge disappointment for many activists in Bolivia, especially environmental activists. And so the partner organization that we have in Bolivia is definitely very vocal about this and vocal about the role that the government has had really in the vanishing of this lake and in the ongoing drought.
Well, right now you're a young feminist fellow, which is a strange term, I think, but please tell us about WIDO, the Women's Environment and Development Organization.
So I am currently actually no longer a young feminist fellow with WIDO, but I was until up to the end of last year. WIDO is an incredible organization. It stands for the Women's Environment and Development Organization. It's an international advocacy organization that primarily attends and engages in international negotiations from the SDGs, which is the Sustainable Development Goal process, and the UN Climate Talks. And so WIDO supports women to be advocates, to be representatives, to be on official government delegations in those spaces. It attempts to raise awareness, to give out information, and to assist on a technical level. Again, both civil society organizations that are attending these spaces and also the government delegations. So giving information as to the connections between the importance of women's rights and acting in the face of climate change, what one has to do with the other, what women and women-led organizations around the world are doing in the face of climate change, and collaborating with other civil society organizations, again, to raise awareness and to provide technical assistance, to give information, to raise awareness and all of that good stuff. So people should definitely check out WIDO. The fellowship I had was also in collaboration with FRIDA, which is a young feminist fund. So FRIDA gives out small grants to feminist-led youth groups around the world to focus on different issues, and climate justice is one of them. And they have recently closed a current grant cycle, but they open grant cycles up every couple of months. So that's also a really good resource for people interested in finding out more. They have research, they just are a really good hub, again, for connecting young feminists from around the world.
And I know we have a lot of women listeners on Radio EcoShock, and of course we have the men who care about them. What would be your parting thoughts of advice as we face these big changes coming up in the future climate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely important to create community. In my climate activism, I really try to not lose sight of what are the structural causes behind climate change. And so, you know, we talk about CO2 and parts per million and you know, the levels of fossil fuels in the atmosphere and 2 degrees. But really, you know, we can't lose sight of the machinery that's behind that, which is the political system. It's the economic system that isn't letting us move beyond these unsustainable sources of energy that are unsustainable for the planet and also for people. So not losing sight of the connections between the environment and people and inequality. So again, you know, making these connections, environmentalists cannot forget about people, about communities, about indigenous groups, and vice versa. And so when we think about climate change, taking into account these structural causes and what's really behind the problem, then we can also begin to build alternatives that are deep set, that are really transformative, that are radical in the sense of getting to the root of the problem. So if for example, heightened individualism, you know, is part of why we live in this current climate crisis, then we have to be building communities and we have to be strengthening our ties to each other. And we can't work alone. You know, we have to work together. We have to build community because it's good for us, because it's good for the planet, and because that is reversing these power structures that are ultimately, again, unsustainable for the planet and unsustainable for people.
We've been talking with Maria Alejandra Rodriguez Acha from Peru. She's an anthropologist, educator, activist, and young feminist. I'll put short links to a YouTube video with Mahandra, her Huffington Post article, and the organizations we have talked about, all in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. You can follow up there. Mahandra, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.